This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Toni Jordan, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to the Wheeler Centre tonight for this fantastic event. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to the elders of any other communities who might be with us tonight. Before we begin, I might just take a moment to ask you to put your phones on silent. It's always handy. And if you'd like to tweet about this, just put at Wheeler Centre at the end, and then we'll all be able to follow what's going on. Our special guest tonight is Madeline Tien. Madeline is the author of four books, including the short story collection Simple Recipes and three novels. These are two of them: Dogs at the Perimeter, which was came out in 2012, and this is Do Not Say We Have Nothing, which was just recently shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It's an absolutely amazing book. I can't wait to talk to Maddie about it. Please join with me in welcoming Maddie. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
I wanted to start by asking a bit about you yourself. Did you always know you were going to be a writer? Was that always the plan?
There was a time when I thought I was going to be a ballet dancer.
Oh, really?
But actually, ballet was my older sister's dream, and I was sort of tagging along behind her and falling in love with the art form through her love of the art form. Mm-hmm. But my sister also taught me to read. She taught me to read before I started school. Right. So it feels like something I'd always done and was always part of my way of interacting with the world. So I think very early on, for me, it was the most magical thing one could do, create a story. And it was what I wanted to do from the beginning.
So it was something that you always knew. Did you have any juvenile attempts at writing? Did you write things when you were young?
Yeah, a lot. My sister and I wrote these little books together. Right. I think a lot of kids do, you know, where they're like storybooks and you illustrate them. And then as a teenager, a lot of poetry. A lot of sad poetry.
And then you went on. Was writing away the plan after school?
Actually, when I went to university, I studied dance.
Right.
I studied contemporary dance and ballet. Wow. And then, complicated story, but I lost my scholarship and ended up at a different university, where I then turned to literature and writing.
Do you remember the first idea for your first novel? Do you remember where all that came from?
The first story?
Yeah, the first thing that you wrote that was published properly.
Oh, it's a short story called Simple Recipes, mm-hmm. and it became the title story of my first book. It's about family, and it's one of those stories that I started writing without having any idea where it was going. It looks into the subtle dynamics inside a family and love and violence inside families. And it really took me by surprise. It's a difficult story. And it became a story that each year I would rewrite it entirely from scratch, almost like feeling like whatever it was about, it was just buried underneath another layer, and mm-hmm. if I just kept excavating, I would get to the story. And it took about 5 years, I think, with that one.
So there's two things I want to ask from that. I do want to come back to this idea of families, because that's something that's through all your work. But I also want to ask about this idea about writing without knowing where it's going. Is that how you write the novels as well? Is this how you wrote this one?
Yes.
Tell me about your process for that.
It feels like with this one, it was multiple things that sort of came into collision. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to write about the 1989 Tiananmen demonstrations. I had been wanting to write about them for a long time. They had moved me so tremendously when I was 14 or 15 years old, and it was my first glimpse into China. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to write about some events that happened when I was young, when a young woman came to Vancouver, and my mother sheltered her for maybe about a year.
Wow.
She was a young woman who didn't have the proper papers and didn't have anywhere to go. And my mother found a home for her. And then because my parents were working all the time, very typical immigrant story, I ended up going to this person's house every day after school because she didn't have papers, because she was afraid, she never left her apartment. And so for a little girl looking for company, in a way, it was almost a kind of security that I found with her.
That's an amazing story, because that works its way perfectly into Do Not Say We Have Nothing, where the novel opens with Marie, who is 10 at the time. She's lost her father at the time of the Tiananmen Square events, and a young woman comes to stay with her, and that's the beginning of the story.
Yes, and it's so funny. The circumstances of the woman my mother sheltered, completely different, but it was that relationship between a little girl and an older girl mm-hmm. that really stayed with me, and the difference in languages.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to starting to write this, because it's such a complex book. For those of you who haven't read it yet, it's Marie's story, Marie who is 10 in Vancouver in Canada in 1989, but it's also the story of families back in China, and actually it's the story of three events in Chinese history: the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and the Tiananmen Square Massacre. And they're all kind of worked in a very huge, sweeping family kind of story, something that's almost Russian in scope, if you know what I mean by that. I'm interested to know how this came about. You've given us the idea that started it, and then what happened from there? How did we know all these other people?
It's a novel of multiple doorways, in a way. So you sort of go through one doorway, and it leads to these unexpected passageways. And it is a bit like constructing a house. You have to just keep going through the doors, and then you get a sense of the spatial structure that you're in. I thought that I was writing a 120-page book about the Tiananmen demonstrations. Right. And then what I had learned over the many years of thinking about Tiananmen is that, you know, if you remember 1989 and seeing the students in the square and the demonstrations that went on for 6 weeks, and how there were so many moments where it seemed like it was going to turn out a different way. And then we all... It was reported that the massacre happened inside the square, and the Chinese government always said there was no massacre in Tiananmen Square. And in fact, they were correct. And this is part of the confusion and the denial of what happened. The massacre happened in the boulevards and the roads leading to Tiananmen Square, when everyday people, workers, factory workers, parents, high school students, came into the streets to stop the tanks from reaching the students. So what I realized I wanted to write about was that older generation, even though it was the students that I had initially felt this deep admiration for. Mm-hmm. And that's why the scope of the book seems vast, you know, this canvas of 20th century Chinese history, but in fact, it's really just the birth, the life, and the death of a young man that we know as Sparrow. And it's just the times that he's born into mm-hmm. and the way that history turns him over and upside down and sideways, and how it comes to be that he walks into the streets that night on the night of June 3rd.
I can understand that from that perspective. So at the core of the historical story, if you like, there's three people. There's Sparrow, there's Kai, and there's Zuli, who are all musicians. And the role that music plays in this novel is really remarkable. I assumed that you were like a very accomplished musician who plays all these instruments and composes by how you've addressed it. Is that the case?
No, I play nothing. Actually, I said this to someone, and they said, "Oh, but you play the radio." And I was like, "Yes, I play the radio." I wish I played music. I wish I could play the violin. I studied the piano for about a year when mm-hmm. I was very young, so that's all I know technically about music. And then the long exposure to Western classical music has been through ballet.
We might ask you to do a small reading now that we've talked a bit about the book so that everyone can have a taste of the remarkable prose that is in it.
Yes. I have the tattered pages here. This is a very brief reading, just 3 or 4 minutes. It's 1940s China, a village called Bingpai. A young man was sent away to the United States to study, and on his return, he brings many, many, many books, and he's given the nickname Old West. And Old West dies too soon, but he leaves a little girl, a daughter named Little West. Little West grew up terrified of her father's books, as if they held a disease that could destroy a village. Little West packed the books into a container and buried the lot of them. Her only son, born long after she had given up hope of a child, was the apple of her eye, and she hoped he would grow up to be a proper landlord like his great uncles. Instead, the boy lost his head to poetry. The boy was a walking cartload of books. He sat at his desk, calligraphy brush in hand, gazing up at the ceiling as if waiting for words to swallow him. His bedroom appeared to float, disconnected, above the solid world of transactions, commerce, and land. She called him sometimes gently, sometimes roughly, Wen the Dreamer. He was an observant and sensitive teenager, and when the war came, it broke him. In 1949, when the fighting ended, Little West sent him to Shanghai, hoping it would restore his vigor. Books made all his pockets heavy. When acquaintances met him on the road, Wen said he couldn't stop to discuss the communists or the nationalists, Stalin, Truman, or the weather, because he was composing a 6-character, 8-line regulated verse in his head, and any variation in his path would push the words out of order. It was a lie. In fact, he was empty of poetry and afraid of words. During the war, Bingpai had been ravaged by the worst famine in a century, but he himself had never known hunger. He had sat in his study, memorizing ancient and modern verses, while outside laborers ate nothing but tree bark, mothers sold their children, and young boys died horrifying deaths on the front lines. Half the village of Bingpai starved to death, but the gentry, inheritors of seemingly limitless resources, survived. Now the Shanghai literati were talking about a new kind of poetry, a revolutionary literature worthy of a reborn nation, and the idea of it both moved and troubled him. Could the avant-garde express the ideas that went unspoken? Could it confront the hypocrisy of lives like theirs? He did not know. When his poems came back from one of the revolutionary journals, a thick brush had scrawled across the page, "Excellent calligraphy, but your poems still sleep in their pastoral prison. Moon this, wind that, and who cares about your bloody grandfather? Wake up." He knew they were right. Wen kept the rejection letter and threw the poems away. He remembered Bertolt Brecht. "I would also like to be wise. In the old books, it says what wisdom is, to shun the strife of the world and to live out your brief time without fear. All this I cannot do." By chance, he wandered into the New World tea house. A young woman was singing, and Wen the Dreamer, perplexed and enchanted, listened to her for 5 straight hours. Afterwards, he wanted to speak to her, to commend the harsh beauty of her music, but with what words? The young woman's music contained poetry and the written word, and yet it traveled far beyond them to a realm, a silence he had believed inexpressible. Wen wanted to call out to her, but instead he watched her disappear alone up a flight of stairs. Nothing had shifted. The world was still the same. And yet, walking home, Wen felt as if his life had snapped in two. He stood for a long time looking at the muddy, sleepless river, which in the darkness was only a sound, trying to understand what had changed.
Thank you so much. It's just gorgeous. It's just so gorgeous. The whole book is just so gorgeous. They're dangerous things. Music is dangerous. Books are dangerous. They're dangerous in the story, but they're dangerous at these points of Chinese history. Can you tell us a little bit about that, historically, how that happened, how it became that music was considered a bad thing?
Mm-hmm. I think we almost expected of literature, you know, so many dissident writers and so on, the threat of literature seems something that is not so surprising. Music is an abstract art form, and in this case, it's traditional forms of music, Western classical and Chinese traditional. And in the revolutionary society, as it was told to people, this was a revolutionary society that was going to make the just society, the new man and woman. And that newness wasn't just a throwaway word. It was a new reality that was going to be created. And so these old forms of art, of thinking, they carried the old person, mm-hmm. the old man, the old bourgeois structures, the old hierarchies, the old ways of thinking, the old beliefs. And that's why, if they wanted to create the new society, they had to destroy everything that carried the artifacts of the old. Mm-hmm. And of course, in a totalitarian state, when it's decided that violence is the appropriate means to make this happen, it's not just the ideas, it's the carriers of the ideas, which are the people. And so as the campaigns intensified, as the power struggle went on inside the top ranking cadres in China, the methods of the extent of destruction grew deeper.
Yet people take extraordinary risks to save books, to keep them, and to keep music, to keep their instruments, to hide them from these kind of times. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I think it's probably true in every society in which there is this threat to the complexity of what a person is. I mean, on the one hand, I think over time people will learn very quickly how to speak the new revolutionary language. Mm-hmm. You learn the register. You learn the kind of language that that your public self needs to use. And that split between public and private will happen gradually or quickly, but it will definitely start to become a difficult passageway from public self to private one. So I think part of keeping the forms, passing the books around, the hand-copied books, burying records and mm-hmm. compositions and pieces of music, photographs even, it was a physical way to, in some ways, bury that private self,
right.
But keep it ready for a future date.
But it was an extraordinary act of courage as well, because when they're found, the circumstances aren't good. What happens is not good.
Some of the things people did, are extremely reckless, extremely dangerous. And some of the stories that I came across, I could hardly believe the risks that people took. But also, everything was going hand in hand, so people also destroyed a great deal that mm-hmm. was important to them, because they really had very little choice. And it's about protecting not just yourself, but the people around you, right? Because it's all about the networks of connection. And
yeah.
Is your father, what class label is your father? How close are you by degrees of separation to a class enemy?
Well, you kind of posed that question as well. What happens when you are the enemy of your own principles? So these students at the conservatorium are very patriotic and really believe in China, and then they slowly come to realize that now they are the enemy because they play this kind of music and they have these instruments, and they all react to that slightly differently.
Yes, I think maybe in ways we can all understand, there's a desire to believe. And if you are part of a society that is telling you that all of these sacrifices are difficult and painful, but they will lead to that better society, and when you know that there has been great injustice, I think that desire to believe and that desire to purge yourself can be very strong, and mm-hmm. especially in the younger generation, who were willing to sacrifice a great deal in service to the revolution. In some ways, that yes, the destruction is a continual force, but in some ways, the ebb of aspiration is also the continual force, and the different ways it gets sometimes twisted and sometimes realized.
That's also a really interesting part, because you have these three people who've seen so much of Chinese history. Then when the Tiananmen Square protests start, they kind of, a lot of people are amazed that the students could be so naive to think that this was all going to end up right, when they've been the ones that have been kind of sheltering them from the reality of the history of China. Did you think that?
They came of age in a China that was opening up in the 80s, bit by bit, here and there. But I think it is astonishing when you think of the student leaders who demanded in 1989 to have face-to-face meetings with the top leaders of the Communist Party. It is actually quite astonishing. But at the same time, when the demonstrations started, they started around the funeral of a reformist leader named Hu Yaobang. Hu Yaobang had been purged, and then he had died. And the students filled Tiananmen Square to mourn Hu Yaobang, and through mourning him, to mourn the ideas that they believed that he carried and the direction that he had wanted to take China. And this has been quite common in China, the use of a public funeral to grieve deeper injustices mm-hmm. that have been ongoing. But the students famously decided to present a petition to the government, and the students went to the Great Hall of the People, and they got down on their knees and they lifted up this petition as if waiting to offer it to an emperor or a father figure. And it's a startling image to see these three young students kneeling on the ground with their petition raised up in their hands. And you could say that this is the moment the Tiananmen demonstration started, because nobody came out to receive the petition. And the students were kneeling on the steps for 45 minutes, and all around them, students, but people their parents' age, workers, were weeping and saying, why do we have to speak to the government from our knees? You know, we need to stand up. We need to stand up and address the government. We should no longer have to be in this position. And that, I think, is what lit the fire of the 1989 demonstrations.
Do we know how many people died in those demonstrations?
I don't think we'll ever know. It could be several hundred, it could be several thousand. I think, you know, the work of the Tiananmen mothers has been extraordinary and very mm-hmm. courageous. And they've gathered several hundred names. But this is still the most sensitive event in Chinese history. It's been 28 years. It is the most highly censored event, continues to be. And I'd say it's even more censored now than it was 5 years ago. And every year the list of words that are deleted from the Chinese internet around the June 4th anniversary, I mean, that list is a very moving list. I mean, it's the words you would expect, June 4th, and then all the code words around it.
Maybe you could explain that a little bit more about the censorship, kind of
right.
How that works.
Yes, it's called the Great Firewall. So keywords and posts with keywords or newspaper articles with keywords, they're just routinely deleted. So you'll just get an error page as if it doesn't exist. And I think the censorship software is getting so sophisticated that even now, sometimes you don't get the error page. It's just whatever it is that is sensitive has just been removed. Right. So you don't even know that it's gone.
Right.
But around June 4th, some of the words that have gone missing from the internet today, yesterday, tomorrow. In some ways, it is a fascinating form of remembrance mm-hmm. because this is the event that they would like to scrub clean yeah. in a way, and yet the extraordinary amount of attention that's paid to remembering it every year by erasing it yeah. is quite deep.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I would like to ask you a few questions about the research that you've done, because there are, we were talking before, there's some real people in the book and the real circumstances of what happened to them. There's also, you've got sort of footnotes at the back explaining all the things that you've done. How did you go about constructing such a vivid and real world for these people to live in?
It's the most mysterious of questions. Even the novelist doesn't know sometimes. It is. I think of them as forms of friendship. These are people you get to know slowly over time, and they don't tell you everything at once. And it's sometimes just by your proximity to them, or that you just stubbornly stay with them month after month, year after year, that things begin to be revealed. But I will say that I had never written a book in which they came so much to life for me. I was surrounded by them all the time. Mm-hmm. And there are many endnotes in the book, but in some ways the endnotes are also their own forms of doorways. They are books within books. They sort of play with the idea that in China, official history is quite controlled. What can be said, what can't, how it's understood, whether Mao got it 70% right and you 30% wrong, and so on. There is an official way of thinking about things. And so in some ways, literature, music, art, photographs, they become this vast repository of unofficial history. And they get knitted together in these different narratives. So I think of this book as just one way that these pieces of unofficial history were knitted together, and the endnotes at the back kind of point to that frayed edge at the very end that we could just keep going continuously.
Did you interview people to find out their experiences?
I don't tend to do formal interviews. What I tend to do is go for long stretches of time. And most of the time was spent in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. I wander a lot in different parts of the country. I get... in China, I often found that when people found that I was traveling alone, they became very concerned. Not because I was a woman or because I was traveling alone, but they thought that this must be the most lonely form of existence. And that... that the whole idea of traveling was to be with people and to have fun mm-hmm. as a group and mm-hmm. to make noise and to do all these things and to, you know, and so I would constantly get adopted by the internal tourism economy in China. So families, couples, people on their honeymoons, you know, people.
That sounds lovely.
So in some ways that, I think I would never call it research. It was almost like... I just wanted to absorb as much of the place as possible because I was writing a book, yes, but also because I was so endlessly fascinated by this place and that I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it raised so many questions in me. And part of all of this, the living and the writing and the traveling, was to get at what it was maybe that was unresolvable in me mm-hmm. that I was recognizing in the country also.
Were people reluctant to tell you their stories about the revolutions in the past?
I never directly ask about it. If it come in some ways, because it's a novel, not a journalistic work, what you're actually deeply interested in the ways people move around the past.
Okay.
How they do or don't reference it. Yeah.
Just the very fact that they don't want to talk about it is an important thing because mm-hmm. it's about how they construct their own history, I suppose.
Yes. And in terms of, you know, nitty-gritty research, yeah, all the books, all the trips I made, I was, of course, gathering things all the time. And the Shanghai Conservatory has a museum on its grounds. It's quite hidden away. And it has a room that's devoted to the professors and students who lost their lives during the Cultural Revolution.
Well, maybe you could tell us a bit about He Luting.
Yes. He Luting was a very famous composer in China, and he was also the president of the Shanghai Conservatory of Music in the 1960s. And at a certain point during the Cultural Revolution, the Shanghai Revolutionary Committee decided they needed, what they wanted to do was have a televised struggle session. So during the struggle session, it's basically a denunciation meeting. So in this denunciation meeting, there would be a stage, there would be an enormous crowd of people, a mob, denouncing Herluting. He would be beaten, tortured on stage until he confessed to his crimes. Confession was a very deep part of the Cultural Revolution, self-criticism and confession. And so, as the first target of one of these televised struggle sessions, they chose, of all people, a composer. They chose Herluting. And it's quite a famous event because what they expected to happen was what normally happened in one of these sessions, was that people were so devastated, so much in pain, so humiliated, so wanting to be absolved in a certain way.
The shame is an enormous
part. The shame is enormous, enormous. It drove so many people to suicide. And this didn't happen with Herluting. He kept grabbing the microphone from the Red Guards, and he kept repeating the words, "Shame, shame, shame on you for lying." And he repeated this over and over until they had to cut the broadcast. And it was so out of, not what people expected, that they tried to do it again a few months later, but the same thing happened. It's an extraordinary moment and very rare.
And one of the rare stories where he came back to the work and is still remembered.
Yes, he was put in prison. Most people would have thought that he had been executed. He went to prison, and then the story is that after he'd been in prison for 6 or 7 years, Mao Zedong said to someone, "What happened to that composer who wrote that song?" And then he mentioned the song. I think it was "Song of the Gorillas" or something. And the person told him he's in jail, and Mao said, "It was a very good song," and he was released.
Wow. So your three characters in the historical bits, Sparrow, Kai, and Zuli, they all react to the circumstances of these events in a very different way. Can you tell us a bit about that, a bit about some of the possible ways that people internalise and cope with all these changes that are going on?
They're a microcosm, the three of them. And they're also a microcosm because until that moment, they feel that their deepest loyalties are to each other. There's an immense amount of love between these three. They're also musical collaborators. So they have this relationship on different levels of intimacy.
So Sparrow is a composer, Kai is a pianist, and Zuli is a violinist.
Yeah.
And they are very tight as a group.
Yes, thank you. And they all choose differently, and they all choose their betrayals differently. In some ways, I would say they all betray something.
Yep.
Sometimes they betray themselves, sometimes they betray each other, sometimes they betray the revolution. But each one has to make that choice. And I think it's also about what happens to the artist, who might tell themselves that the art needs to survive, that their capacity as an artist must survive, that it has a value through all these difficult times, and that it still must speak to the people, and how to protect that. And they all come to a very different answer of what it is actually that needs to be protected and what the art actually is.
It's a story where these three characters are the most important part of the story, but there's also all this texture and interest in the background. So In thinking about music, there's all the kinds of explanations of the music, the cycles of the music, and the cycles of the Chinese history. So the three kind of big events that you touch on is the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, and the Tiananmen Square. Can you tell us a little bit about how they have a cyclic nature of Chinese history, really?
Yes, and you could push it even further to the first revolution, the Sun Yat-sen revolution, and then the May 4th demonstrations and so on. I think what is so, for me, intensely moving is the aspiration that never quite refuses it to disappear generation after generation. And
they're so optimistic on that level. They think that this is going to be the thing that will make things better.
It also seems each time like this is the historical moment in China and even globally when this is the change that is afoot. This mm-hmm. is the, this is China, but it's also a wider movement that they're tapping into. You know, the title is from the Chinese Communist Anthem, which is the translation of the Russian, of the translation of the French. It's the Socialist International. But in the Chinese version, it becomes, "Arise, slaves, arise. Do not say we have nothing. Mm-hmm. We shall be the masters of the world." And it was the anthem of the 1949 generation, the Mao Zedong's generation. But it was also the piece of music that the students chose to, this is what they sang when they left Tiananmen Square on the night of June 3rd. So in some ways, it's how this aspiration and idealism gets reworked through the different generations. And also the how complex it is that the words stay the same. And what it might mean if the words stay the same, are we constantly moving in place, coming back to that same mm-hmm. in a way, failed attempt to overturn what we may actually be by instinct. You know, I think these cycles are about violence and goodness and how the forces of violence are justified to the revolutionary cause, which is believed to be linked to goodness, and how we've never actually found a way to disconnect those mm-hmm. two things. And thus the return and so on, yeah.
Did you know very much about Chinese culture before you began this story?
It's a hard question in a funny way because my Chinese is very poor. My mother's mother tongue is Cantonese and my father's is Hakka. And their common language when they spoke to us was English. And neither spoke Mandarin. So I'd say yes, culturally, I knew a great deal,
mm-hmm.
but concrete, probably not. You know, it's a funny thing of for me in China feeling very, very separate, but I don't know. I become invisible there, and there's something that inadvertently touches you about that.
Of course.
Yeah. It's strange, I must say. I have very mixed feelings. We were talking about the complex emotions that China elicits in mm-hmm. you, and there is a love. Love-hate is strong, you know, but there is a kind of deep admiration and deep frustration and astonishment at what's been accomplished but immense sorrow. Many people don't know that in the 27 years that Mao was in power, the low estimate of the number of people who died unnecessarily, the low estimate, is 60 million people. This is a number, I think, that has not been mourned, and has not been mourned in China, which is why it comes to the fore in these cycles. Yeah. It's still there. It's just under the surface.
And I have done the four-hour queue to see the tomb. And inside the tomb, people still, they bow, they get right on the floor. And 70-30 is the answer when you say, Mao, people say 70-30. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, that was that he was 70% right, 30% wrong.
That's what they mean. When you say, what did you think of Mao, which you never say like that, you kind of edge around it, they go 70-30. That means he was right 70% of the time. There's this small 30% that hardly matters in balance. But
yes. But it's such a complex place, as you know, is evidenced in the chat boards and online conversations and the kind of information that is passed around, and why actually the Chinese government has moved to make it illegal to be anonymous on the internet.
Yes,
because it's actually also a place where there is immense debate, there is a lot of disagreement, and there is people can separate the facade and the reality. I think people are very savvy, mm-hmm. and they know. It's almost like there are registers of existence, and people become adept at shifting between them. And always knowing, you know, just how intricate the social relations are.
Do you think this, have you had feedback from people in China? Do you think you'll have trouble traveling there in future?
I don't know. I'll find out soon. I have had feedback. There's been a lot of interest in the book in China, even though it can't be published there. It's just too sensitive. But I've had different conversations with publishers. Could we publish, you know, the first two thirds, and then literally, if the last third can't be published, could we just leave the book ending in mid sentence? You know, so, I mean, there's different ways it could be.
So that's fascinating. So that they're acknowledging the last section is just this incredibly moving and beautifully written piece about putting everyone in the spot in Tiananmen Square at the time. It's a perfect cap to the story, but the whole idea that they understand that that's the bit, that's the difficult part. We can talk about the Cultural Revolution and all that earlier stuff.
Yes.
But ending it, finishing it mid-sentence is an acknowledgement that the Chinese reader will understand to mean we've taken something out here. There's a gap here.
There's a gap. It's to make that gap visible. You know, people know it's not there.
Yeah.
And I have found with Chinese readers who lived through the Cultural Revolution, one of those is my stepmom, my father's partner, and her circle of friends. One of the things that's so amazing to me is they have read the book so carefully and looking for any small error, like in this particular... Yes, it's just brilliant, because they're like, at this point in 1964, I don't believe that this particular person would have used the word comrade to address this person. and it's it comes from this, because they love the book so much, they don't want any error of fact to be allowed to undermine it, even though it's a work of fiction, it's a work of literature. But I think that speaks very much to the Chinese experience, is that what can't be said in the factual realm then is subsumed in different ways in art and literature. And so there's this balancing act of, yes, this is literature, but here's a factual thing that can't be spoken in another form.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, very soon I'm going to be asking if you have any questions for Maddie. I have one more question before then. Typically, we have a lot of emerging writers in our Wheeler Centre audiences, so I wondered if you had some advice for people just starting out as novelists.
Yes. Well, I think it's writing. It's a hard road. There's no question about it. It takes a lot of persistence, a lot of courage. It takes a lot of questioning of how you do things, why you do things. And I think one of the most powerful things for me is the year by year, bit by bit, letting go of, in some ways, my conception of the world and my language around the world. Because the language that you choose is very much the framework of your thinking. And it sets the possibility of how you can think about the world, but it also sets its parameters. And so the joy of fiction writing is that you're always pushed out of your language if you're really listening to the characters, if they actually really have taken over the page in that sense, that they are actually speaking their own, through their own parameters, their own conceptual frameworks, their own sort of particularities, which are not just about idioms or turns of phrase or the surface things. It's actually very deep, the connection between their language and their way of living in the world. And I think that is what takes a lifetime to become more and more attentive to. And but that is the pleasure also. Yeah. It's
Thank you so much. I could go on all night, but now it's your turn. We have two people with microphones on each side. If you would like to ask a question of Maddie, please put up your hand and they will see you. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Maddie.
Hi.
Could you talk a little about the relationship between Sparrow and Kai and why you portrayed it as you did, please?
Yes. Sparrow and Kai. Sparrow is the composer and Kai is the pianist, and they have a bond that is probably the fulcrum of the whole novel. It's a very complex relationship. It's a very intimate one. It's also a very artistic one. And it is also that thing when the person makes the art that moves you so tremendously, you fall in love with the person. You know, there's something in that relationship. I felt with them that so much of the relationship is silence. Silenced silence. It's in a way they are what's left behind in a revolution where all forms of love and desire and ardor were no longer supposed to be personal. They were all meant to be in the service of the revolution. And so what do you do with this personal love that feels so much about serving the self? And in denying it, they try to be what they imagine will be better people. But it shifts. Yeah, nobody asks about that relationship. It's a really interesting one. People sort of, they don't want to give it away. Also, and also it's a subtle relationship. I think that's why it's one that's hard to talk about, and it's one that sometimes will frustrate a reader, because is this love? What form of love is this? And why does one give up so much for the other? You know, over and over again. Yeah.
Thank you,
Madeline. Congratulations on your latest beautiful work of art.
Thank you.
And thank you, Tony, for that very good searching interview.
Thank you, Helen. Hello.
I'd like to ask you, please, Madeline, about what you said about your relatives reading the book.
Yeah.
Now, because I haven't got to the end, maybe you mentioned it there, but I'd like to know now, did your family members read the manuscript before it was published, so that we have now got the version where there's no comrade, for instance, where they shouldn't, or did they read it afterwards?
They read it afterwards, and the fault is entirely mine, because I am always holding on to the book. It's off to the printer, and I'm still making the changes. So they read it in galley form. And they read it slowly. So actually, the changes have come over multiple printings. So I'd say the most recent printing is now the one that so far has everything fixed. But I love that it's still shifting in a way. It's very much in keeping with, in a way, some of the ideas inside the book, that this book is never really going to be one thing. It's going to keep getting copied and recopied, with errors being introduced or removed at different points. And that is the life of a book. Yeah.
We have some Maddie relatives in the audience.
Yes, I was going to say.
Yeah, actually.
I have a whole row of family. Because it's my Malaysian-Australian family who all live in Melbourne and have been here for a long time.
And Melbourne is quite important in your story.
Yes, my parents met in Melbourne. They were both students here. And yes, this was a long time ago, in the 60s. Yeah.
Thank you, Madeline. That leads into my question in a way. In the early 2000s, I provided accommodation as a homestay mother to a number of international students, and I teach English to international students. One day, one of my students came out of her bedroom. She was white. She had found out about Tiananmen Square. I'm getting emotional. I did live in Shanghai for 4 years too, so got an interest. I'd like you to comment on how you think that experience then of international students coming to Canada and Australia and finding out these things that they've never been told, how do you think that affects them as a person, and then they go home and tell their parents and their community? What sort of effect does that have?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's a great question, it's an interesting one, because it's got an ongoing answer in a way, because it has been so many years. 28 years. and a hard one for me to answer, because I suspect that each person is going to integrate this information in very different ways. And that there are those who will have already been prepared for what they might see. They may already have some inkling, right? And there are those for whom it will be a complete shock and will seem not quite real. And it will take a long time to sort of fit the pieces together. And it will depend on interest. Some of them, it may seem a very long time ago. And I'd also say the narrative has always been shifting, because I think I often hear, even with people who would be my age or older, who were part of the demonstrations or who knew a great deal about them at the time, there has been a movement towards saying, well, maybe the students wanted the change to be too fast. Maybe in the long run, what's happened has been better for the stability of the country. Maybe, you know, if you compare it to how the Soviet Union collapsed, maybe in the long run, more lives have been lifted out of poverty, more opportunities have been made with that, you know. So I think it's a very, very complex question, because people will answer it in very different ways. But I do know, I think it happens to all of us. There's the kind of way we experience our countries when we're within it, you know, and the kind of disagreement that is possible when you're in the country and you can critique, and there's all, you know, that kind of, but when you're outside and you hear that critique of your country, you may respond very differently. There's a protectiveness that comes over, and then there is always an instinctive, but you don't understand how complex this place that I've come from is. So I think it would happen for all of us, and it's how all that comes together in one person that would be the answer.
Thank you for your question. Thank you. Thinking about the cyclical nature of Chinese history makes me think that we haven't seen the last of these kind of events. What is your opinion of this?
Absolutely true, yeah. But it's very hard to say. I mean, at this moment in time, it is quite startling to see quite how reasonable Xi Jinping looks sometimes compared to other world leaders.
We know what you're talking about, yes. There.
And that actually is very strange, a bit Hall of Mirrors-like, but also difficult for internal politics in China, because it doesn't help the dissidents inside the country. Mm-hmm. And the crackdown of the last year and a half, which has been the crackdown on human rights lawyers, the disappearance and arrest of human rights lawyers, this is, I think, one of the most... this is really terrible times. And the targeting is interesting. They are targeting the people who uphold China's constitution. So they're actually targeting people who uphold the law. And it is reaping very strong effects.
Other contemporary events that bring to mind the importance of literature in your book is what's been happening also with the Hong Kong booksellers.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so as people will know, this is the disappearance of the booksellers from Hong Kong, and also those who were living outside in Sweden, or in Thailand, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this is cultural revolution tactics. This is, what is the phrase? Other people who speak Chinese better will know it. Is it killing the chicken to scare the monkeys?
Right.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened with the human rights lawyers and with the booksellers is the use of public shaming and public confessions televised. And it's a powerful tool because it introduces very quickly a chilling effect. When I had events in Perth, I was with the writer Mei Fong, who has a book about the one-child policy, and we were talking about how 5 years ago, both of our books, we would have thought we would very quickly have found publishers in Hong Kong, and that has not been the case. There's a lot of hesitation, a lot of anxiety, and China and Hong Kong, I mean, this is David and Goliath. The change has happened much quicker in Hong Kong than I ever anticipated.
Thank you. We have another question. Thanks.
Hello.
Hello.
Politically, So much talk, films, the recent one by John Pilger about China as the superpower and US as a superpower being displaced. Do you have any comments at all on the growth of China's economic power and as other power as a power base, and it's going to possibly replace the United States?
Yes, I think that seems... I'm sure that that's probably quite evident here, I would
very
think.
Much.
And even Canada is doing a pivot towards China. It was probably inevitable. I think what's more surprising... I don't find China's heft in the world very surprising. I do find the quickness of the decline of American empire very surprising.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, I'm sure Australia, but all through Southeast Asia, this has been evident for the last 10 years, that China is the force.
Yeah. Yep.
Thank you, Maddie. You mentioned the over 2 million people who received amnesty after Tiananmen Square and went to the US.
No.
I'm wondering if you've had any feedback from any of them on your book and what they make of it.
Only the little bits and bobs I see on social media. That's it. Have I got anything directly? I've had a lot of mail, but I don't... Not from the student... Not from anyone who was student leader or anything like that, no. It's... I don't know. I don't know what they'll make of it. I hope, as with all fiction, you hope that... that you get to the core of some fragment of human experience that will feel that you haven't erased something that they lived through. That is, I think, sometimes my great fear as a fiction writer in creating the story that tries to pull something to the surface, that you don't overwrite what it is that people really live through. And there is that hope that actually it will... they'll recognize themselves in it. I've heard that more from the Cultural Revolution generation. I'm not sure why the response has been quicker there. I don't really know. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I loved your book, Dogs at the Perimeter.
Thank you.
Which is set in Cambodia. And I wondered, what was the moment when you decided that you were going to write the book about Cambodia? And was there any connection, in a way, between writing that first and then moving on to Now We Have Nothing?
Yes.
Do not say we have nothing.
That's a great question, yeah. They're very, very deeply connected, even though they're very different books. Dogs at the Perimeter is a very fragmented, very difficult, very... quite relentless, I think, novel about the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian genocide. And I know when I was in Cambodia, I spent a lot of time in Cambodia. It was the place that spoke to me the most in Asia for a long time. And I didn't think that I was going to publish this book. I was thinking my way through Cambodia's history and what was so visible in the present. But I didn't think I would publish it for a long time. It was a complicated decision to do that. But to answer the second question, this book was so painful, Dogs at the Perimeter, and it left me with so many unresolved questions. And it also left me thinking that language was so fragile and so limiting. It felt like so many of the things I had wanted to express, I just didn't have the capacity or the language. And in some ways, it was a book I was really proud of, but a book that also I felt that I had failed the subject matter. And that's where I was in this interim before I started writing Do Not Say We Have Nothing. And at that point, I turned almost entirely to other forms of art, drawing and music. And I remember listening to Bach's Goldberg Variations, which is an aria, very simple aria, that is then reworked into 30 different variations and canons. And I was so depressed, and I was listening to this piece of music, and for whatever reason, who knows why these things happen, but it just moved me so tremendously. And it also seemed like the way it was reworking its themes allowed the simple line of music to suddenly contain playfulness, joy, comedy, sorrow, intense melancholy, and the full range of human emotions, and then come back to the first aria, but having taken you very, very far. And it made me think that that's what I had failed to do with Dogs at the Perimeter, and maybe there was a way for a book to try to use that motif, but to pull it apart in more complex ways.
Thank you for that. So, ladies and gentlemen, Do Not Say We Have Nothing is a symphony of a book, really. I found it so moving, but also incredibly optimistic, because the very fact that people go to such lengths to restrain and obliterate art makes me realise what a powerful force it is and can be. We have loved having you with us tonight, and please join with me in thanking Madeline.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.